We're doing Parshat Korach. We'll quickly go through the parasha. So we have the wealthiest Jew of the time, Korach. And he teams up with Datan and Aviram, the two brothers, and their cousin On. And they come before Moshe. They summon 250 firstborn heads of tribes, heads of courts. And they come and they say, boy, you guys took way too much for yourself. What a holy congregation we are. Hashem is in the midst of everyone. Why do you take all this honor and lord it over the people? And Moshe falls on his face and he says to Korach, you want tomorrow morning, Hashem will show us who he's chosen and we'll take those pans which Nadav and Avihu died when they handled them. And if you guys think you can do it, so you and your congregation, everyone will put fire and ktores in the pans. And one is going to walk away alive and the rest are going to die. So if you want to, God's given you so much honor, you Levites. If that's not enough, you're welcome to try and challenge Aaron in that. And Moshe pleads with Korach. He says, please, sons of Levi, don't you appreciate how much honor God's given you? You're the chosen ones to serve Hashem. You were chosen to come close. You also need to be the priests. You should realize that you're challenging Hashem here. You're not challenging Aaron. This Hashem said so. And Moshe sends to summon Dasan and Aviram, and they say, we're not interested. Even if God says so, we're not willing to accept this, that Aaron should be the leader. Look, you took us out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us here in the desert. Now you're also going to be the big boss over us. You didn't bring us to that land flowing with milk and honey you promised. You didn't give us land or vineyards. You want to blind us? You think we're stupid? Now Moshe gets very upset because the 250 heads of courts, you could assume that they meant well. But when people say, even if Hashem says Aaron's supposed to be Kohen Gadol, we're not interested, we don't think it's fair. So Moshe is very upset and he says to Hashem, please, don't accept any offering they offer at this point. With all that they all harmed me in my past, and that they had me almost killed by Pharaoh, and with all the things that I never took a thing out against them, I never took revenge for all the things they did to me in my past. And now, look at what they're doing to me. Moshe turns to Korach and he says, tomorrow you and Aaron and your men are coming with the pans. And they do that. They put pans and they stand in the entrance to Olmoid with Moshe and Aaron, and Hashem appears. And Hashem says to Moshe and Aaron, separate yourself from these people. I'm going to wipe them out just like that. And they both pray and they say, Hashem, one man is the cause of all this. Don't be angry at everyone. So Hashem tells Moshe, tell everyone to distance themselves from the camp of Korach, Datan, and Aviram. Notice that Datan and Aviram are worse than everyone else. Because Datan and Aviram say, even if Hashem says so, we're not interested. We don't think it's fair. And so Moshe says, stay away from these wicked people because you don't want to be taken down with them. So everyone distances themselves. And Datan and Aviram come out, and now they're starting to blaspheme, and their true colors are coming out. And their families are standing there with them. And Moshe says to the people, he says, here's the sign that I am the messenger of Hashem, and I've not done anything of my own accord. If they die a natural death, then I am not Hashem's messenger. But if the land opens up and swallows them, and they go down alive into their grave, so then you'll know that they blasphemed. And when he finishes speaking, so the land opens up under them, and they get swallowed. Datan, Aviram, Korach, all his wealth and all of their wealth. And then the land closes up. And everyone runs. There's an earthquake. Everyone runs away. And a fire comes out and the 250 men drop dead. A godly fire. And Hashem tells Moshe, tell Elazar to gather the pans which they used because they meant well. They actually meant to come close to me. And we will use those pans as a lining for the Mizbeach, and that will be a sign that people should be respectful of the Mizbeach. Not everyone can come close just because they want to. And that's what they do. Hashem makes a promise. Lo yiyeche Korach. There will never be someone like Korach, which we would read to mean as a part of the commandment. Hashem's saying, align the Mizbeach, and this way people will be reminded and no one will challenge you again. There will not be like Korach. The Rambam writes that it's actually a promise, that we don't find that anyone came after Korach and said Moshe was a liar. That's the promise, that he will be believed. The next morning, everyone comes and complains and says, you killed our 250 heads of state. And when they're coming and complaining, they're actually taking sides with those 250 against Moshe. And at that point, Hashem tells Moshe, stay away from them because I'm going to wipe them out now. And Moshe tells Aaron, take the pan and take fire from the altar. That's where we take fire for the pan. And with the Ktoris, go, because that will stop the plague. And there's been a plague, and 14,700 people have dropped dead in those few seconds until Aaron comes out with the pan. And with that, the plague has stopped. So Hashem tells Moshe, take a staff from each head of tribe, and then you'll put it in the tabernacle before me, and they'll see that only Aaron's staff will bear fruit. And that's what happens. The next morning, each one takes back their staff, and they're all dry. And Aaron's staff is filled with fruit, and everyone sees that's a sign Aaron's supposed to be the leader. And they leave the staff there as a sign. The people tell Moshe, we can't handle this. We can't be so close to the temple. And so everyone concedes that Aaron should be in charge, and Aaron and the Levites are responsible for the temple. And at the end of the parasha, we have the different gifts that the Kohanim get from the people. The firstborn, the firstborn animals, and the gifts that the Levites get, the Miser. And that's the end of the parasha. So now let's see the parasha with more depth. Yes, Daniel. That's what our sages say. That's what our sages say.
Yes.
Yes, that's what our sages say. Yes.
I don't understand Rambam's opinion, because I think we've seen many people who have tried to overturn half of the words, especially in Moses Mendelssohn and Moshe.
Let's see. Let's see when we get there. Let's go slowly through the parasha and see. Okay, so our parasha begins with a few fundamental points. First of all, Korach is the wealthiest Jew. He has 1,000 camels. Just to carry the keys to the storage houses that he's taking with him in the desert of wealth. So he's the wealthiest Jew. Who was the wealthiest non-Jew? Haman. Right? So we find that the wealthiest Jew and the wealthiest non-Jew lost their life in pursuit of honor, and in pursuit of honor which their wives was spurning them to pursue. And Haman also had a wife who told him, go after it, don't give in. So this is a recurring theme here. That's number one. Number two, Korach was shaved as part of the process of becoming a chosen Levite. He comes home all bald, and his wife says, who did that to you? And he says, Moshe. So she says, you know what happened? Moshe went home laughing the whole way. He says, look at what I did. All the Levites think they're holy now. I shaved them all. You're all walking around like baldies. What do you think is going on here? And so Korach's wife, she says to him, Korach comes home after the story of the last week's parsha, mitzvah of tzitzis. So Korach tells his wife, I want you to make me a four-cornered garment. She makes him a four-cornered garment. He prepares the strings. He puts in a string of blue wool. Now they're super wealthy. So his wife says to him, what are you doing with one little string? I could have made you the whole garment blue if you would have asked. Korach says, no. This is a sign of royalty. This is the mitzvah. We have one blue string in the tzitzit. She says, really? That's a sign of royalty? I'll make you royal clothing. I'll make you a royal blue jacket. That's royalty. You want to be royal? A whole jacket that's blue is royal. What do you need one blue string? What's royal about that? Why? And if you make a whole garment that's blue, do you still need one blue string? Korach says, yes. She says, and that's royalty? You have the whole garment's blue. What do you need that for? Korach comes to put up a mezuzah in his house, and his wife says to him, what you doing? He says, I'm putting up a mezuzah. It's a mitzvah in the Torah. She says, our house is filled with scrolls of the whole Torah. You need one little scroll of two parashiyot on the door? That's what's going to make the difference? And her questions are mocking. She's looking to knock, and she's saying, you know, Moshe's fabricating things here, and you should be the leader. You, Korach, you're a man of stature. I should be married to the leader of Israel. You got to go out there and fight him. Don't let him get away with this. And so his wife pushes him to fight Moshe. And Korach is going to make a lot of jokes. He's going to take all these questions his wife asked him, and he's going to go around asking them. And he's going to mock the Torah that Moshe's teaching. And what's really bothering him and his wife is that when there were appointments to positions of leadership, he wasn't as high up as he thought he should have been. And that's one of the dangerous things when you're a leader. People are very, very concerned about their own honor. It's interesting that they checked out, they asked, they did a research, they asked many employees, if you were told that we want to give you a project, and if you do this project, then we will give you one of three things. Either $1,000, and look, you'll be able to spend those $1,000 buying yourself a new cell phone, going on vacation. There are so many things you could do out of that appreciation that the company has given you. Or choice number two, the company will say, we will have greater appreciation for you because we will give you a gift, and now everyone will know how much your work is appreciated here. Or choice number three, you will move the company forward and you will have much greater appreciation among the hierarchy and the staff. Everyone will know what a worthwhile member of the company you are. So the average person said that they would be much more inclined to do the job with number three. But the average person also said that they think that if you want everyone else to do it, you have to use number one or two. Meaning the average person, it feels they are altruistic, but no one else is. That's the conclusion of the research, that when asked which should be used as a way of getting people to comply, people tended to think that everyone else needed the other forms of encouragement, but for themselves, people tended to choose the third, the more altruistic one. One of our challenges when we run a family, when we run a corporation, when we run an organization, one of the challenges is to make people feel valued. When Korach feels he's not valued, so then that's what's going to lead Korach the wrong direction. So I'm starting from the perspective of us as leaders. But Chazal stressed the other side of it. Chazal stressed, how are we as members of a team, as members of Klal Yisrael? And Chazal said, we have this weakness called jealousy. And jealousy is self-destructive. And when we see someone else get something that we don't, we have to remind ourselves that from the beginning of the Torah, jealousy is what brought down the world. Cain brought the first sacrifice after his father. Cain brings a sacrifice, and that's fine. He makes a mistake in his sacrifice, but Hevel comes and competes. Hevel takes a sacrifice, and he says, I'm going to do one better. I'm going to be like my dad. I'm bringing an animal. Cain brought fruits. I'll bring an animal. And when Cain sees that Hevel's sacrifice was better accepted than his own, Cain becomes jealous of Hevel and murders him. So the world begins with jealousy. and jealousy about who's going to be closer to Hashem. So even in religious things, we have the potential for this weakness to come to play, the weakness of jealousy. Hakina v'ta'ava v'kavod, jealousy, desire, honor, motzin et ha'adam min ha'olam. They cause man to die, to leave this world. And many of our decisions are driven by those three. And that's when we're in danger. So Korach is driven by jealousy. Haman is driven by jealousy. Korach's wife is driven by jealousy. The 250 men are not exactly driven by jealousy, and that's why their pans will forever be a part of the Jewish people, because they are driven by a desire to come close to Hashem. But Korach, no, he's coming and he's mocking. And we have to be very careful when people make jokes and they make fun of things and everyone's laughing. Sometimes that's a sign I should step away from this conversation. It's not headed in the right direction. So Korach begins by saying, you're doing it for yourself. And here we see a second fundamental point in human relations. The second I view the other person as being self-centered, we're going to have a very difficult time coming to peace with one another. If I view someone else as being in it for themselves, so then there's very little they can do to convince me otherwise. Because even when they'll try to make peace with me, I'll explain it. Of course he wants to make peace with me. It's in his interest to be at peace with me. The second we frame someone that way, then they're going to have a very hard time getting out of that framing. And one of the challenges in every marriage, one of the challenges in every argument is not to enter that mode of thinking. We very easily enter that mode of thinking. And there are so many examples. I like to tell the story about a kid that came every Friday night after davening. I give a candy to the children. And this child has a sister who's a little older, and she doesn't come into the men's section, and every Friday night, he would take a candy for himself and his sister. And one Friday, after he takes his candy, I run out of that type of candy, so I take out a bag of a different type of candy. So as he's walking away, he sees I'm taking out a different type of candy. He comes back with the two candies I've given him, one for him and one for his sisters, and he says, can I exchange this for the new type of candy? So I said, fine. And I gave him the new type of candy, took back the old one. And I said, but why don't you exchange the other one? If this one's a better candy, why don't you exchange the other one for your sister too? So he looks at me and says, I did. I only exchanged for my sister. I judged him wrongly, right? I was sure he only exchanged one for himself. And he, for himself, he wouldn't have bothered. He only came back for his sister. You know, and he looked at me like, what do you want from me, Rabbi, right? I'm supposed to be the rabbi here, right? Yeah, so we have a pitfall here. It's very easy to fall into that pitfall, to look at someone else and say they're thinking about themselves. And once we think that, it's very hard for the person to justify themselves. So Korach is coming with a claim. You guys are doing this only for yourself. And he's saying it against Moshe, and he's saying it against Aaron. We know that Moshe begged Hashem for 7 days that he does not want this position. We know that Moshe is the furthest thing from this. He doesn't accept any payment. Moshe comes on his own little donkey. He's the poorest man in Israel, and he's not interested in benefits. But they're going to make that claim. And that's what happens when you have jealousy. Jealousy can blind us. Blind us to the point where we see the most pious person as being self-centered. Okay. Yes. So that's a machloket among the commentaries. We'll go with the understanding. There are commentaries that say that once the decree came out in last week's parsha about the Jews having to spend the next 40 years in the desert, the time was ripe for Korach to rebel. Not everyone agrees that this happened in the second year we were in the desert. Others say it was at the end of our time in the desert. There are two opinions as to when the story takes place. But we'll go with the one that it happened directly after the decree that we're stuck in the desert. Our sages say, Ulkav atzamot kin'ah. The Pasuk in Mishlei says, jealousy is like rotting within the bones. When a person is jealous, he's very focused, he's very small-minded, and everything's about, let me catch up with the Jones, let me beat the Jones. It can't be this other guy got ahead of me. It can be at work, it could be in yeshiva, it could be in marriage. So, Korach goes and summons people. He summons Datan and Aviram. And Datan and Aviram, let's review our history with them. They are the two brothers who were fighting in Egypt, and Moshe came up and saved them, and he stopped them from fighting, and he said, why do you hit your fellow man? The next morning, Datan is being beaten to death, literally, by an Egyptian who just slept with Datan's wife. She thought it was her husband who came back home, and she didn't realize that it was actually this Egyptian. And when Datan figured it out, so the Egyptian was beating him so that word would not get out. And as he's beating him, Moshe comes on the scene and saves his life, kills the Egyptian. And Datan, remember, I'm sorry, I got it in backwards order. He saved Datan day one, and then day two, he sees Datan fighting with his brother, and they're exchanging blows, and Moshe stops them, and then they say, what are you going to do, kill us like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? We're telling Pharaoh, and they go and tell Pharaoh, and Moshe gets incarcerated, and Moshe goes on death row, and they actually bring him to the place of execution, and a miracle happens, and Moshe escapes. But technically, they were ready to kill Moshe after he saved Datan. Moshe comes back to Egypt. He's already 80 years old, and he goes into Pharaoh, and now Datan and Aviram have lost their wealth and their stature, and after he comes into Pharaoh, so things get worse. Pharaoh makes the decree that no more giving the people any hay. They have to go and collect their own straw to make the mortar. And Datan and Aviram, who are now old people, come out and say, Yeira Hashem ve'yishpot. God should see what you did to us. Asher yivashtem et rechenu. You made us stink before the Egyptians. Now they have an excuse. They're killing us. And they yell at Moshe with such an embitterment that Moshe gets hurt and he turns back to Hashem and says, Rabon Shalom, what'd you send me for? Look at how the people are suffering. Things are only worse since I came. And Moshe gets punished that he will not enter the land of Israel. Hashem alludes to it right then. And still, Moshe does not reveal any enmity for Datan and Aviram. We leave Egypt, and we're in the desert, and again, we have two wise guys, these old men already, right, who are leaving over from the man, and then they go and tell the Jews, God said no man's going to fall today on Shabbos. We went out, and there's man out there, and they try to make everyone discredit the miracle of the man in Moshe, and this is Datan and Aviram. So we've had a long history with them. And now Moshe, who has repeatedly treated them fairly, and he never took them to task over everything they've done to him, now he has to face off with these two brothers once again. And their uncle, On ben Pelet, their cousin, who is also a descendant of Reuven. And Korach comes with his arguments about the mezuzah that we described, the tcheles that we described, and he convinces the 250 men, we're all worthy, we should all have the right to bring sacrifices to be close to Hashem. And that's one of the challenges in life, that like I tell my children, wicked people will sometimes have a long beard, wear a big black hat, and look very, very observant. Don't assume that a sinister person is going to be dressed with, he's going to have horns coming out of his head, and he's going to be carrying a little pitchfork, and he's going to go, ah, ha, 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 ha. It's not going to work that way. Wicked people sometimes have a long white beard, and they have a black hat, and their tzitzis are flying in the air, and they quote you things from Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim, Shas, and yet they're wicked people. Korach was a learned person. Korach had levels of prophetic vision. But Korach could not overcome his partiality, his interest in himself. And so Korach comes with arguments that are in the name of Hashem. One of the dangerous things is when people come in the name of Hashem. It's hard to know. Are they for real? Or are they coming with self-interest? I had a conversation with someone this week, and he said to me, you know, I have to tell you, I'm on this question, I really feel that my only thoughts are L'shem Shemayim. What does Hashem want? And I said to him, that's funny, because I always say that I don't know if I could ever say I do anything L'shem Shemayim. You know, it's an interesting line you're telling me, because I wonder if I can ever do something L'shem Shemayim. Can I ever overlook myself? I'm in the picture. I'm a human being. I have my desires. I have my interest. Can I ever overlook that? Can I really say something I'm doing is for the sake of heaven? You know, the rabbi said that when a person does something wrong, he says, oh boy, I hope I'm in incognito mode, right? No one should see what I'm doing. Everyone else understood. That was a reference to Google Chrome. Rabbi Eliezer said to his students, you know, and these were the students, these were the rabbis, and he said, when we do something wrong, we look over our shoulder and we say, I hope no one saw that, but we don't say, gee, their Ribbono Shel Olam saw that. So it's difficult for us to really be L'shem Shemayim, but we should certainly be suspect when someone else comes in the name of heaven. So Korach comes in and says, in the name of heaven, we're all such holy people. Why should they take all the honor to themselves? And you'll notice this is a recurring theme. Kol haposel b'mumo posel. When a person says there's a fault in someone else, almost always that's because they themselves have that fault. That's a very scary thing when we find fault in others. So Korach is saying, you guys are only interested in honor when he himself is interested in honor. Now, Moshe is in a point where, how do you defend against that? I'm not interested in honor. I'm the leader because I'm really fit to be the leader and God said so. It's very hard. That's why Moshe falls on his face out of humility. And he says to Hashem, it's up to you. Our sages said, he said a very tough line to Hashem. When he saw that there was nowhere to turn and that Korach was intent and the 250 men and Datan and Aviram were intent, he said to the Ribbono Shel Olam, if you do a miracle and show everyone that everything's legit, good. And if not, I'm leaving. I can't continue this position because then I'm not trustworthy. Then I'm joining their side. Because there's no middle ground. Sometimes you have to cut the line and say, this is wrong and this is right. This is a lie and this is truth. Sometimes there's no other way. And so Moshe says, Ribbono Shel Olam, you have to do a miracle here, and it has to be very clear that the Torah is true, because otherwise everything's up to question. The fundamental point of Torah is that Moshe is going to be honest, and whatever he says is what Hashem said, and if there's any room to doubt that, then there's nothing. It's an all or nothing. A guy came to me this past Shabbos, and he said to me, he's not an Olei Chadash, so I don't know, maybe he said it in Hebrew. So he's not a native Hebrew speaker. I don't remember if he said in Hebrew or in English. But he said the following line. He said, my wife's a little pregnant. So I wanted to explain to him that it's either yes or no. There's no, like, but then I realized what he must have meant is that she's in the beginning of her pregnancy. She just, right, she's a little pregnant. But Moshe says, Ribbono Shel Olam, it's either a yes or a no. And it's an all or nothing deal. And Hashem obviously is going to side with Moshe. Korach comes, and when Korach comes, he's playing a game. He brings 250 heads of state with him. He brings Dathan and Abiram with him. And even though he's talking, he's trying to give Moshe and everyone else the impression that we're all one. We're all against Moshe. And what Moshe does, if you look closely at his wording, is Moshe says, there's Korach and his men. You're not all one. This is Korach and you're all his men. And when Moshe speaks to them and says, Korach and Adato, he is calling Korach's bluff. Very often when a person tries to lead something that's wrong, what he tries to do is share the blame. We're all doing this, right? We all agree on this, right? We're all doing this. And it's a good tactic when what you're doing is right. You want to have and Moshe calls that bluff. Moshe wants to give them time. Moshe threatens them with something that they've seen as lethal. That's why Moshe says, we'll take the Ketoret. They've all seen that even the holy sons of Aaron dropped dead when they used the Ketoret inappropriately. And they were Kohanim. They were the sons of Aaron. And Moshe is making it crystal clear to them, you're not going to walk away alive from this. So you better believe what you're doing and you better rethink it, because I'm giving you something that you've seen the chosen ones, the sons of Aaron, drop dead when they used it without Hashem's say-so. So you want to do this challenge? Fine. But Moshe's point in saying, let's come tomorrow and let's take this, is that that's something which they know they won't live out. And so his hope is that will scare them. They'll say, okay, Hashem didn't tell us, dude, we're not doing it. But they don't. Because they're really convinced that they can also be close to Hashem and that Moshe fabricated everything else. I don't understand how that happened. In all honesty, I don't understand. They saw Aaron's two sons die from it. How could they think Moshe made it up? I don't know. So our sages say that Korach distracted them all night. They didn't sleep that night. Korach spent the night telling jokes. Korach spent the night with them partying and speaking about how foolish and illogical Moshe's Torah was. Here he is telling us you need a mezuzah, but you have a room full of scrolls, but that mezuzah is going to make the difference. And he was cracking jokes all night long. And sometimes the way that people can convince us to do what's wrong is by mocking what's right. We always have to ask ourselves, did he say something of value or did he only knock the other one? Very often by putting down the other, that can cause people to overlook that the person himself doesn't have content. When we were growing up, my father would always tell us, don't call yourself a misnaget. You have to have an identity. If your identity is just that I'm against him, that's not an identity. If that's your, that's not an identity. So Korach spends the night bashing Moshe. Yes?
Does it state exactly, I have a hard time believing that they all would go in and do the same exact thing by bringing in a strange fire. Are they all having a piece of the fire that's already previously burning on them?
Yes. They all took the fire from them as bad. It happens to be that in all of the Torah, the Targum translates Ketoret as Ketoret Busmin, Ketoret of a pleasant smell. And over here, the Targum just translates it as Ketoret. So there are two interpretations. Either the Targum meant to say that this was uninvited, so it's not Ketoret Busmin, it's not a good smell, because they were doing it of their own accord. Or else, others want to say that they didn't actually put all the spices of the Ketoret in there. Moshe invites Datan and Aviram, and Datan and Aviram call Egypt the land flowing with milk and honey, and they're touching that sore point, which everyone, it's sore by everyone, they're not going into the land of Israel. But when they say, even if Hashem says so, we're not coming, they're touching on a very, very true point. Very often we approach halacha and we say, that can't be what the halacha is saying. Let me see, maybe a different rabbi says differently. But what we're really saying is, that can't be what Hashem is saying. And if sometimes you open up a chumash or you open up Shulchan Aruch and it says that, what a person's really saying is, I don't want to accept it even if Hashem tells me. And when he's pushed to the corner, then a person says that. So it's true. As a person grows, more of the Torah resonates with him. When you start out, there are parts of the Torah which you have a hard time swallowing. And in the beginning, it can be many things. In the beginning, it could be eating kosher, keeping Shabbos. Then you grow, and suddenly keeping Shabbos becomes second nature, but eating kosher is still difficult. Then you grow some more, and eating kosher is second nature, but family purity is still difficult. There are a lot of things that are not easy. We have to be careful to see what is our weakness, and what is really the truth. there's a world of a difference between someone who says, this is the Torah and this is right, and I'm not holding there. I'm not yet ready for that. At least he's maintained honesty. It's legitimate if I say, I'm not yet there, I'm going to work, mitzvah, I'll get there. But I've maintained the ideal is true. What's happening here is they're putting down the ideal. And then when push comes to shove, Datan and Aviram say, we don't care if Hashem said so, we're not in. And that's when Moshe says, Hashem, don't forgive them. I've never taken them to task. And I always love this pasuk, because you see very often pious people, and you can feel like they're a friar in modern Hebrew. That when people take advantage of them, they don't make an issue of it. They let it go. So you think they didn't notice. So Datan and Aviram all these years have done Moshe so much harm, and he never, never took them to task over it. Now he turns to Hashem and says, I never did anything bad to them, even though they did all that bad to me. And here we see that the same Moshe who could retain that Hakarat HaTov and say, I owe it to the Nile, I owe it to the sand, all the good they did for me. When I killed the Egyptian, I hit him in the sand. So 65 years later, Moshe still feels a feeling of gratitude to the sand. When I was born, they put me in the Nile, and I stayed alive for another hour until I was found by the daughter of Pharaoh. So 80 years later, he still has a debt of gratitude to the Nile. For that 1 hour, his casket was floating in the Nile. So you look at that and you say, wow. And then you come to our parsha and you say, you see, 65, 68 years later, Moshe still remembers that they're the ones who put him in prison, and they're the ones that almost got him killed, and they're the ones that made him all the problems afterwards when he came back, and he says, but I never did anything against them. And here we see, we have an insight. The tzaddik is not one who's stupid. The fact that he's willing to forgo things doesn't mean he doesn't remember. He remembers. He knows. And he says, okay, I'm not taking them to task over it. So, they take their pans, they put the fire, and Korach comes with his men, and things are happening, and they're missing On ben Pelet. So they send messengers, go call On ben Pelet. Now, there was one very pious woman, which was On ben Pelet's wife, and she says to him, gee, who's going to be the boss here? So he says, Korach. So she says, and what do you care? Does it really matter to you if it's Moshe or Korach? You're not the boss either way. Right? She says to him, either way, you're not the man. So what are you fighting for? What's the difference? You're not going to be promoted out of this. So he says to her the classical male response, but I told them I'm going to be there. Right? Your wife tells you, you know, it's very dangerous. You guys are going drag racing. I just heard people die from that. What do you say? But I told all the guys I'm going to be there. And she says, call in sick, and you say, but I told them, you know, men are stupid this way. Excuse my bluntness. I told the guys, right?
Who are the guys?
So On Ben Pelet says, I said to everyone I'm with them. Now I'm supposed to be the ninny that pulls out. And what does she tell him? You go to sleep and I'll deal. That's a smart wife. You think that she'll say, I'll hold your hand, and you tell them, no, I'm not doing it. You think she tried to convince him and say, don't you understand? You made a mistake. Be a man and get up there and say no. She doesn't do that. The wisdom of a woman is when she can help and get around things. The men always take things head on. Yeah? Go tell your mother that I said we're not coming for Shabbos. We were there last Shabbos and the Shabbos before. And I don't care if your brother's coming back and this is the first time he's back in 30 years. We're not coming this Shabbos, right? Men go with their principles. Oh, wow. Yes. As though that's what's going to change the world. And women say, let's get around the problem. So there's a problem. You go to sleep and I'll deal. And very often, you win. Which is exactly what happens with On. She sends him to sleep. She sends him to sleep. You see how man we are? He doesn't stand up to them. He goes to sleep. I say we because we're all the same way. You know. So he goes to sleep. And she sits there, and when they come, they see her doing her hair, and it looks like things are a little bit intimate in the On ben Pelet household. So every time messengers come and they see something that looks like they don't belong there, they walk away, and they figure we'll come back in another 10, 15 minutes. And And by the time he wakes up, Korach is dead, Dathan and Aviram are dead, the whole story is over, right? And her wisdom was not only in proving to him that he's wrong, but she didn't force him to stand up and say, guys, we're wrong, we're not doing it. Maybe he wouldn't have stood up to that. She was able to get him out. She got him an out without forcing him to stand up against everyone else. So our story reveals to us how men will very often think they're running the show, but really they're following their wives. Our sages say there are those who follow their wives to the Garden of Eden, like On ben Billet, and there are those who follow their wives to perdition, like Korach. So Natan of Rangenthal adds an adjunct. What you see from this is that we're always following. We think we're leading, but at the end of the day, we're still following our wives. And that's what the Talmud says. There was once a pious man and a pious woman. He married someone who wasn't pious. She married someone who wasn't pious. After 20 years, he was like his wife, and her husband was like her. Meaning the wife forms the husband. At the end of the day, her husband became pious. And he followed his wife, and he was no longer pious. And that's a perspective. When we're looking for a spouse, sometimes people say, but she's on such a high level. Well, if you guys match, if everything else works, and you're not pressured, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Could be that that's what'll help you maintain your level. Could be that's what'll elevate you. You have to see if you match, if she's not pressuring you. But a woman will usually be ikar habayit, the essence of the house. She will give the tone in the house. So Moshe tells everyone, Hashem tells Moshe, tell everyone, distance yourself from the camp of Korach, Dathan, and Aviram. And here we see how destructive Machlokas is, that not only Dathan and Aviram die, but their children do too. Our sages say that Korach's children, in the last second, they did tshuva, and that's why they were saved. Korach's children were spared, and that's what we have in Psalms, the songs of the children of Korach. I don't know why, but future generations continued calling their children Korach. We find in Chronicles, in Divrei Yamim, that people called their children Korach, and I don't understand why. I mean, Korach is known for his wickedness, so it would seem you shouldn't call your child Korach. And in fact, today we do not. But I don't know why in Chronicles it seems that they continued using the name. I also don't know why in Psalms we repeatedly call them the sons of Korach. There's a message in that, why they're called the sons, the descendants of Korach. It's not a claim to honor. On the contrary, it's a shame. And yet they are chosen people. And they composed certain psalms that we have. Usually their psalms focus on the world to come, the good that's yet to come. Okay, so the people complain the next morning, which is mind-boggling. That after everything they saw, they can complain. And in fact, they pay for it. 14,700 people die. What we see here is a recurring theme in Tanakh. Hashem sends Aaron with the pan to stop the plague. So our sages say that very often people thought that God only punishes because they saw the 10 plagues. So when we leave Egypt, the first thing that happens is we have water that's not palatable. No one wants to drink it. And Hashem cures the water. Hashem is showing them, I don't only punish. People saw that the ark would destroy, so Hashem showed them that the ark cures. People saw that the staff would bring punishment, so Hashem showed them how the staff brought out water from the... Yeah, so we repeatedly have this concept. So here, people were convinced that the pans and the ktores, there must be something poisonous in them. So Hashem showed how they stopped the plague. And this goes back to the story of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, who was told there was an arod, there was a poisonous snake next to the Beis Medrash. So he said, go show me the hole. They showed him the hole. He put his heel over the hole. The snake came out and bit his heel and dropped dead. So the students all picked up the arod and carried it into the Beit Midrash. And they said, you see, this teaches you. It's not the arod that kills, it's the sin that kills. We think it's the snake that killed the person. No, it's that he deserved to die. The snake didn't kill someone who didn't deserve to die. So that's a recurring theme. And that's why Hashem shows them here, the pan can save people's life. It's not about the pan. It's not about the ktores. It's about whether people deserve to die or don't deserve to die. Our sages have an interesting conversation here. They say that when Aaron went with the frying pan, that was a secret that was revealed to Moshe when he was in heaven receiving the Torah. So when the angels saw he won the debate and that he was going to get the Torah, so Hashem told the angels each of them should give him a gift. So the angel of death gave him this gift. He said, I'll tell you a secret. When there's a plague, the Ktoris will stop the plague. So now there's a plague. Moshe remembers that. He sends Aaron out with the pan and the Ktoris. So it says that when he came, the angel of death said, get away from me. I have to continue my job. And Aaron said, no, I'm coming to catch you, to stop you. So the angel of death said, God sent me. So the angel of death says, God sent me. So Aaron says, Moshe sent me to stop you. So the angel said, I'm telling you God sent me. And you're saying Moshe sent me. So I think I should continue doing what I'm supposed to do. So Aaron said, Moshe doesn't send me if God didn't say so. If Moshe sent me, then you're supposed to stop. And if you don't believe me, come back with me to the tent. And Moshe and Aaron, and Hashem is there with Moshe, you could ask. And the Medrash says, that's why it says, Aaron returned, which can mean he returned, he brought someone back with him to the entrance to the Ohel Moed. He brought the angel of death. And there Hashem said to him, yes, obviously if Moshe sent Aaron, obviously I also said the plague should stop. But that's right, so it sounds comical, but there's a message there. Okay, so we have the story of the staffs. Yes?
There was one time that there was a plague, and there was a snake on the top of the staff.
We'll get there.
I'm sorry.
We'll get there. Not in this week's parasha, but we'll get there. You're right.
Sorry, but... they were supposed to look at the staff, but they weren't looking at the staff. They were looking at the Hashem. That's the
right. Right, that's the concept,
deal.
Right.
Okay.
It's Mishnah, then Rosh Hashanah, you're right. Okay, we should note many things here. We should note, number one, that the tribe of Levi actually paid a price. When the tribe of Levi is the ones in the holy, they're the ones protecting the Mishkan, the Jewish people say, we can't come close to the Holy of Holies because we'll die, just like these people died. Our sages say that the numbers of the tribe of Levi were repeatedly less than the numbers of the rest of Israel. And our sages say that's exactly for this reason. Because when a Levite would make a mistake, he'd pay for it with his life. When you're standing there by the tabernacle, as we find in the story of David, they were carrying the ark, and one of the people carrying the ark had to go to the bathroom, so he didn't bother going far away from the ark. He sat right next to the ark and went to the bathroom, and he dropped dead. So he and his brother were responsible for carrying the ark. But when it came time to go to the bathroom, he shouldn't have done it right there. A little bit of respect. He made a mistake. Yeah, but he paid for it with his life. And so the tribe of Levi also paid for things with their lives. And that's why the tribe of Levi, as honorable as their task is, their numbers were always less than everyone else because people simply died. They made mistakes and they paid for it. So that's this idea that the Jewish people say it's dangerous to be so close to Hashem. They're right. Number two, we have the mitzvah of giving the Kohen. So the truma that we give the Kohen, that's a part of our recognition that he's Hashem's messenger in the world. The Kohen is supposed to teach Torah. They're supposed to be the educators, the Kohanim and the Levim. The Torah describes that when you give them, you should give them chelev. The word chelev, what's chelev?
Milk.
Oh, so chalav is milk. Chelev means the chosen. So the fats that we don't eat in an animal, there are fats that are kosher and there are fats that are not kosher. The fats that are not kosher are called chelev. Seems that they're the chosen fats that we don't eat. Those are the fats that are offered in the temple and some of them are, and they're not permissible for human consumption. Even today, when we slaughter an animal, some of the fats we have to take off, they're called chelev. Shuman is the fat that we're allowed to eat, but the word chelev actually means chosen. So the Torah describes your chosen oil, your chosen wine, your chosen crops, you give to Hashem. And this is the idea that when you give truma, when you give the gifts to the Kohen, so you should give your chosen ones. There's a famous story about the Ger Rebbe, who had a pair of tefillin that was written by an ancient scribe. And everyone always spoke about that chosen tefillin, which he'd only wear at special times of the year. And they spoke about which grandson would get those tefillin. So one time one of the grandkids comes and he sees the tefillin are missing. He says, Saba, where'd those tefillin go? Those tefillin that you only wear on holy days of the year. And his grandfather said, I gave them away. So he said, to who? He said, a poor man knocked on the door and he needed a pair of tefillin. So he said, Saba, why didn't you give me your other pair? So he said, when you do mitzvah, you do it with your best. And that was my best. So the Torah tells us that here, Torah says, take your chosen crops and you give that to the Kohen. People sometimes donate their talis that's worn out to the shul, right? But shouldn't you donate a new talis to the shul? I'm saying that that's what the Torah is telling you. People bring their leftovers. That's the difference between Cain and Hevel. I know someone who would give, whenever he'd finish using his car, he'd give it to orphans and widows. So on the one hand, you could say that's beautiful. You know, he's giving, instead of throwing it out, he could make money, he could sell it, he's giving it to orphans and widows. But there's another side to that coin too. We should
give him a good one too.
Right?
Not that much.
Look, there are two sides to that coin. In general, we should definitely find venues in our life where we're taking what's chosen and giving it. You know, I'll give you a simple example. You sit down to the Shabbos table and your wife brings out the food. So one of the things I tried to do when I was a bachelor was I'd go to people's houses and pay attention and try to learn from them. So one house where I went, I noticed that every food that would come out, the husband would take the food, go over to his wife's plate and take the nicest piece and put it on her plate. And I thought that was so beautiful because the woman comes to the table after everyone else has taken what they want and she gets the leftovers. Why? So you take the chosen one and you give it. I'm saying very often we have good excuses why I'm giving my leftover towels to the shul, my rundown car to the orphan. I have a lot of excuses why I'm doing that. But I should have areas in my life where I take the chosen one and I give it to the right cause.
What's more of a real sacrifice?
I think it doesn't have to be the sacrifice component as much as I value what I'm doing. It's not, the issue here isn't that I've lost something as much as I value what I'm giving to.
It's called Hidua Mitzvah.
Oh, yeah. I'm saying even if it's not a sacrifice, it's I value it. You know,
I mean like a korban.
Yeah. Ah, yafe. Tov, we got one more minute. Hashem tells the Levites they too have to give ma'aser min ha-ma'aser. And historically, when the Levites did not ascend to build the second temple, so then Ezra taxed them. It says Ezra was midstream. He was on his journey from Babylon to Israel. And at some point, he took a count. He wanted to see, bottom line, how many people left with us? How many people are really with us? And when he took a count, he saw he didn't have Levites. How's he going to do the temple service without Levites? And then he taxed the Levites. And he took the gifts of the Levites and he gave them to the Kohanim. He said, technically, Kohanim are also from the tribe of Levi. And so he taxed the Levites and took these gifts that we read in our parasha. He took them away from them and gave them to the Kohanim.